Welcome, it's Film Week on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. On this weekend, prior to Super Tuesday in the California primary, later on Film Week, we're going to talk about the best political movies of all time. We'll hear what our critics have to say, and we'll talk with Film Week listeners. Joining us as critics this week, Claudia Puig, the president of the Los Angeles Film Critics Association, Tim Cogshell, film critic for Alt Film Guide and Cinegods.com, and we welcome her first time as a critic with us on Film Week, deputy entertainment editor at Mashable, where she's also film critic, Angie Hahn. Angie, welcome to Film Week. Very good to have you with us.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So we begin with The Invisible Man, a horror thriller based on H.G. Wells' classic novel. Elizabeth Moss stars. The film is adapted by and directed by Lee Whannell. Moss plays a woman whose abusive ex kills himself, leaves her his fortune, but she suspects he's not really gone.
He has figured out a way to be invisible. You know exactly what I'm talking about. He's not dead. I just can't see him.
The Invisible Man is rated R. Tim, what did you think?
The Invisible Man, reference to the H.G. Wells here, but not really. Much more in common with the 2000 film Hollow Man, that Kevin Bacon film with Elizabeth Shue. This has way more in common with that. And also a good deal in common with Sleeping with the Enemy. Remember the old Julia Roberts film? So you take those two films and you squeeze them together and you get this thing. Opens strong. Actually, that whole sequence of her escaping the house. Very, very, very strong. And then we move into this very particular movie, which is where I think it loses it a bit. We have a movie then where we all are with this young Elizabeth Moss character as she is afraid of this man coming after her, right? And then it turns out that he's dead. She's told that he's gone. He's dead. But she still thinks that he's coming after her. Now, we in the audience, we know that he's coming after her because the movie's called The Invisible Man.
We've seen the TV. And we've seen it, yeah.
And so we have to watch a big chunk of movie where she has to convince herself that what she thinks is real is real. And then she has to convince everyone that she knows that it's real. Well, you know what? I don't really want to be in that movie. I want to be in a movie where the invisible man is coming after her and she knows it and she's going to do something about it. She's a victim in this movie for a long, long time. And I didn't really care for that about this
movie. Is that her being a victim explained? Are there some extenuating circumstances? Or is it just she's just slow on the uptake with it?
To me, she's a little slow on the uptake, but it's unfair to insinuate that into her character in terms of the filmmakers, as far as I'm concerned, because she's a sharp, sharp person she is. That thing that happens when she gets that letter, when her sister gets that letter from her, the letter that I was done with the movie because I did not believe for one moment that her loving sister would believe that she would send her that letter in a heartbeat. What do you think, ladies?
So, Angie, what do you think?
The fact that she was a victim for a lot of the movie didn't bother me as much. It's very much a movie about exploring abusive relationships. And one of the points that I think the movie is trying to make is that that kind of thing can happen to anyone. You can be brilliant, you can be smart, you can be strong, and this kind of thing can still happen to you. And I thought that it did a pretty good job of getting into this really warped dynamic that they have and showing you why she would still struggle to get out of it, even though, as you say, she's not an idiot. What did bother me was kind of what you were saying about the sister. I think that as the movie went on, there were more and more little details that just didn't really add up. And it's a movie that asks you to really pay close attention to the details. Like, the performances are really nuanced, especially Elizabeth Moss. I thought she was fantastic. There's a lot of attention paid to, like, the kind of specifics of the abuse that she suffers. There's also just lots of scenes where you're staring at an empty corner and being like, did that curtain move just a little bit? And all of that is really effective. But if you're asking me to pay such close attention to the details, then you can't have things like, you know, the sister thing where you're like, that doesn't really make sense. And, you know, I try to be forgiving. If it happens a couple times in a movie, I usually try to let it go. But I think as the movie went on, there were more and more of them, and they got bigger, and these, I don't know what to call them mistakes exactly, but they got bigger and bigger. And by the end of the movie, I was left thinking not, oh, wow, what a interesting exploration of abuse, but how did that, what was the deal with the dog?
Yeah.
What was he doing?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And then it becomes a smackdown. You know, when it becomes a smackdown, it's kind of fun, you know, because, you know, she's going to win the smackdown. But, you know, it's just not as clever as it ought to have been.
Yes.
The Invisible Man is the film starring Elizabeth Moss, Lee Whannell, the writer-director. It's rated R in wide release. The British comedy Greed stars Steve Coogan. It's written and directed by Michael Winterbottom. Claudia.
Well, echoing what Tim just said, not as clever as it ought to have been either. It's this fictional story of this retail billionaire, and it's set in this very glamorous world. We hop around from Mykonos to back to England. We go back to his childhood. There's a lot of skipping back and forth in time, a lot of jumping around, which doesn't fully work. It just feels a little bit mishmashed. And, you know, we all like to see somebody, a corporate scoundrel, you know, taken down. But it just isn't as clever or as funny as you wish it was. And, you know, the big joke is that his name is McGreedy. So it sounds like McGreedy. So they call him Greedy McGreedy. It's overstuffed. There's a lot of subplots. There's a lot of, little side notes that go off, and I just felt like it didn't cohere.
Well, all that social satire is sitting right on the surface. It's right there. You can see it. You can see the politics and the of the filmmakers and all that. Michael Winterbottom at work here, and there's a lot of improv going in here. Of course, Michael Winterbottom and Steve Coogan, those wonderful Trip to Italy.
Yes, yes.
It's hysterical.
Those are fantastic.
And improv in the context of those movies is wonderful. That's what you want there. You know what's going on. A lot of improv in this too, this narrative film. And I'm watching these scenes, and I can tell that, you know, Steve is just going off. And he's having a fabulous time, and a good deal of it is funny. But it doesn't always cohere, and the other people in the scenes, they're not as good as him.
Well, I will say, I thought that Isla Fisher, is that how she pronounces her name? Isla? She was great. I thought she matched him almost. And he's great. He's always good. I love Steve Coogan. I love those Trip movies.
Those teeth, oh my God.
Oh my God, yeah. He had these great white fake teeth.
Gigantic fake teeth. And everybody knew it. He talked about how they cost $20,000.
Yeah.
But I'm like, whoa, man, those are amazing.
Yeah. Well, the teeth were like a key part of his persona. But I thought that, you know, other people were okay in it. Particularly, I thought Isla was really good. She matched him. Yeah, it was just there's too much happening at any one moment to, you know, for it to really come together and be as funny as you wish it could be, and you, as you know it could be, given Stephen Coogan. Hmm.
I've heard it as Isla Fisher, but I don't know for sure.
Oh, that would make more sense. Okay.
Greed is the film starring Steve Coogan, Michael Winterbottom, the writer or director. It's rated R. It's at the Arclight Hollywood and the Landmark in West L.A. The fantasy film Wendy stars Devin France. The film is directed by Ben Zeitlin, who co-wrote the screenplay with his sister Eliza Zeitlin. Tim, what'd you think of Wendy?
Well, now, Ben Zeitlin, Beasts of the Southern Wild, a couple of years ago, extraordinary film.
One-of-a-kind movie.
Yeah, steeped in the sort of Southern Gothic lore, sort of a fable, a quasi-fable, but it's really just Southern Gothic. Now, here, we have a full-on fable. This is the Peter Pan story, told from the perspective of Wendy in a sort of contemporary setting, yet still set in the sort of Southern Gothic milieu. And we have Wendy, who travels with her little neighbor boyfriends off with Peter on this train to this island. And on this island, all kinds of fantastical things are going on. Now, here in this film, as opposed to Beasts of the Southern Wild, the magic is real. The thing to do with time and not growing up, it's all real. And this gigantic mother fisher living at the bottom of this ocean. It's like a fish. It's beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. You know, all of this is very mystical and magical and moving, but it's a bit too much. And I felt like I'm being forced into this world, this sort of Southern Gothic lore, and then we're wrapping it with the magical realism. And it's like this, you know, sort of tiramisu of all kinds of mythic sort of things going on. And it was just all a bit much for me.
Claudia, what do you think?
Yeah, I agree. Given Beasts of the Southern Wild, which I thought was really great, as, you know, his first effort, there's very high expectations for his sophomore effort, obviously. And so I was very excited. I saw this movie at Sundance. He's clearly influenced by Terrence Malick, and you feel it here. It's very lyrical. But like Terrence Malick's lesser work, it's a bit muddled. And I felt like it was so focused on the imagery, which was really quite beautiful at times, that it really, the plot, the story sort of suffered. I mean, it's loosely based, of course, on Peter Pan, Wendy. And the lead actress, Devin France, I thought was quite good. Not as good, of course, as Kevanjane Wallace, who, you know, in Beasts of the Southern Wild, but still very good. He has a way with child actors, I think. you know, it was strange to me. The part that was more grounded in reality was the most fascinating part to me.
All
the very
that
beginning
opening stuff at the
yeah,
diner. Yeah,
I love the opening stuff at the diner, and I had really, from you know, I was had high hopes. I you know, anticipation for what they get to Neverland or whatever their version of Neverland is, was you know palpable. I felt it, and then once it got there, it kind of meandered because I think he, I felt like he did, wasn't exactly sure what story he wanted to tell. And I don't know, I just, it lost me there. It felt exhilarating and hopeful up to that point, or exciting up to that point, and then it just kind of dissipated for me.
One of the things I loved about Beasts of the Southern Wild was the visuals. And
yes,
for a film that he couldn't have had a very big budget for, that were just knockout visuals in that film. And so this is one that would certainly lend itself to that, but...
I thought the visuals were good.
Well,
but...
that stuff that goes on under the water, that,
yes,
that creature. That's
the
creature that they call
the
mother.
The mother creature, yeah.
And that is quite extraordinary, quite extraordinary. But you're right, it gets so muddled on the island. So I asked myself, what is your point? Good to grow up or not good to grow up? Because it seems like the point of the film is not good to grow up.
But then, again, without a spoiler, yeah, there is a sense of kind of tying it all up in a very redemptive way. Like, but it's okay to grow up as long as you're surrounded
yeah,
by family
but
and
you
people
gotta
love
pick.
You. Yeah.
So, Andrew, what do you think?
I mean, I think what I didn't like about it was that it feels like it's a movie about childhood that is aimed at grown-ups who are extremely precious about the concept of childhood. Like, the lead kid, Wendy, has a lot of voiceover in this movie, and all of the lines that she's given are not things a real child would ever say. It's all like just stuff that an adult would write because they would think, I thought these things when I was a kid. And it's like, yeah, but not, you wouldn't have put it quite like that. So it did win me over in the end a little bit, but I don't know, ultimately it just didn't all come together very well. And it is very pretty, I do give it that, but it's pretty in... I think I walked out feeling like it was a feature-length Google ad, you know, like just like lots of pretty imagery thrown at you and lots of lines that sound like they're trying to be profound.
Mm-hmm.
But then you walk out being like, okay, I don't really know what I was supposed to take from that.
Yeah. It's like don't grow up unless you really, really have to.
Wendy is the film from Ben Zeitlin. The movie's at the Arclight Hollywood, the Landmark in West L.A. It's rated PG-13. And The Frame's John Horn spoke with the Zeitling siblings at Sundance this year. The interview is available on our Film Week page at kpecc.org. The Polish drama Corpus Christi is directed by Jan Komasa, and the screenwriter is Matusz Paczewicz. Claudia, what did you think of Corpus Christi?
I really like this film. You know, it was one of the five international feature, I think, is what used to be foreign language, that category. It was one of the five. And in a year that didn't have Parasite, you know, it might have surfaced to the top. It could have even won. It's really beautifully shot. The cinematography, the lighting, it's very kind of muted and natural, and I was really affected by that. The lead performance, and this guy is probably in every scene, his name is, if I'm not going to completely butcher his name, Bartosz Bielenia. He's got this really haunted face that, you know, with these giant eyes, and he's kind of gaunt, and you just, you know, you're with him. And it starts in a juvenile detention center. He's 20 years old, and starts brutally with a fight. And then you also see him going to mass and being sort of a... acolyte, or you know, somebody who, not acolyte isn't the right word, but he helps the priest and he is singing. And he is sent off on parole to go live in this little town that's actually a beautiful part of like the Polish countryside, to work in a sawmill, which is like this lowly job. And so he's off to do that, and a chance encounter with a woman in a church, and he has this sort of spirituality, and he's drawn to the church. And this young woman kind of sees him and can tell he's a loser, and immediately says, oh, you're going to the sawmill. I can tell you're going to the sawmill. And so he says, no, I'm actually a priest. And, you know, this is kind of, he's pretending. And then he turns out he had taken a collar from the priest at the juvenile detention center. And you're thinking, oh, you know, we've seen these kind of movies, American versions of, you know, movies yeah. like this, Sister Act or whatever. He's going to impersonate a priest. But the turns actually make sense. And so he's sort of... she immediately takes him over to the woman who takes care of the sacristy and says, oh, look, he's come from to visit. Anyway, long story short, he becomes the priest for this town. And this town is suffering with grief over a terrible tragedy that happened. And he helps them. And he helps them in a way that just is very honest. And he looks at, you know, he says, you know, we all have crises of faith. And he does it in a way that isn't rote. And everybody had gone to church and kind of been very sort of, you know, going there and saying their rote prayers and not being really moved.
It sounds like a very touching film. Corpus Christi from Poland is the drama. It's unrated. It's the New Art Theater in West Los Angeles. We'll be back in just 1 minute on Film Week. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. Claudia, your headphones came apart. That's why we have a fundraiser coming up in March.
Definitely
we'll be raising
ones.
Money to get new headphones so Claudia's ear doesn't come off. All right. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPECC. Claudia Puig is with us, also Tim Gogshell, and Angie Hahn making her Film Week debut with us as well. Corpus Christi, the film that Claudia was just talking about, one of the Oscar nominees for Best International film, the movie from Poland. Claudia, just to finish up on it sounds almost like a faith-based but non-formularized faith-based
yes,
film.
Yes, and it isn't really a faith-based film, and it takes some unusual twists and turns, and it doesn't go the way you think it's going to go, the way a faith-based film might go. But it basically examines, you know, redemption and a damaged soul, how a damaged soul can maybe relate to other people in a way that you wouldn't expect. And it's very intense. It's almost operatic. There's some brutal scenes of violence in it, so it's not, you know, faith-based in that sense. It's just a really interesting, well-done, compelling film that I hope people will see, because it kind of has gone under the radar, I think.
Corpus Christi, again, is unrated at the New Art in West L.A. Lost in America, documentary from director Rotimi Rainwater, who is a formerly homeless young man, travels the country interviewing homeless youth and experts on homelessness. Angie, what'd you think of the documentary?
You know, I thought it was a little bit rough around the edges, but I ultimately found it to be really worthwhile. The most compelling part to me was he interviews a lot of homeless youth, as you mentioned, and it's just really interesting and moving to hear their stories, which are stories that we don't really hear that often, whether in pop culture or even just in news articles. And it's, you know, it's informative, it's interesting, it lays out the horrors of childhood homelessness, but also gets into the structural reasons why that happens, the hows and whys. So I found it to be, you know, a little bit kind of uneven sometimes, but ultimately, definitely, I was glad I was watching it.
All right. Claudia, what do you think?
Yeah, very similar. I thought the filmmaking is exactly the word that I had in mind. It was uneven, and it could have used some more deft editing, I think. But what really stood out for me was his connection with the street kids, because he himself had been on the street. And
probably
so
knew what to ask.
He knew what to ask and maybe what not to ask, and just how to draw them out and to show that he really cared. And he really cares. And, you know, yeah, you had all these sort of talking heads, very famous faces. And that was much less interesting to me than the personal stories of the kids who were living on the street. He does throw in a lot of statistics, which are staggering. There was one that really struck me. There's like 5,000 animal shelters in the country, but there's only 400 shelters for homeless children. I mean, what does that say about our society? So
right.
I think he had some really power. And he, you know, some of the interviews with people who are advocates or working for the government in, you know, looking at homelessness, I thought were pretty interesting, too. I just felt like it was heart-wrenching, you know, watching these kids. But he also kind of gave a little bit of you know, like not advice, but, you know, like if you see a homeless kid on the street, maybe give them a sandwich, talk to them, don't act like they're invisible. And that was actually, you know, small and maybe not helpful for the whole problem, but it was nice. You know, the advice was good.
Yeah, I think his goal here is just to remind us that these are people, these are human beings. They're not just random people that you're supposed to look away from and ignore and pretend not to notice. So I think that was the point he really drove home with this. And for all its, you know, flaws, I thought that point he makes very well.
He made a wonderful film about poetry, about slam poetry a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
Rotimi. He's also, in my mind, he was a member of a notable hip-hop group. I want to say CNC Music Factory.
Oh, Rotimi, yeah. That's
in the early 90s.
Production team, yeah.
He's part of that, yeah.
Lost in America, the documentary in which homeless youth are interviewed, something when I was a kid at Hollywood High School, I'd so often be out on Hollywood Boulevard and strike up conversations with kids who were living on the street. And, you know, such a contrast to my experience growing up in a supportive family with, you know, parents who really cared. And so many of the young people told stories of indifference was the best thing. Worse than that was unspeakable abuse. And you learn a lot about what people can endure, and also the resiliency that you see. And I hope the movie does get to that.
He does get to that. And he also, you know, he points out sort of the causes of it. Like, a lot of them are kids who are LGBTQ who have been, you know, shunned by their parents, or a lot, and then like one out of three were in the, I think, foster system. Right. And then, it just, you know, some of them are sex trafficked. I mean, you really see the whole picture. I think he does a really good job of it.
Yeah, and I think one of the ways that's helpful is because the point he's trying to make is that these are people, and it's like a there but for the grace of God go I thing. Mm-hmm. You get to understand it's not like these people, it's not even necessarily like their lives were drastically different from yours. They just had some bad luck or something, you know, something
lost
unfortunate.
Well,
often it's, right. It's more than bad luck. It's parents who are...
Well, the bad luck to have bad parents, I
guess.
Yeah.
Lost in America, the documentaries, Lemley's North Hollywood Theater, The NoHo, It's Unrated. The animated film from Japan, My Hero Academia, Heroes Rising, is from director Kenji Nagasaki. It's based on hugely popular manga and a TV series that spun off from that. Our Film Week critic Charles Solomon tells us about the latest installment, My Hero Academia, Heroes Rising.
Well, Larry, this is one of those properties that you accuse me of making up because they're so popular and a lot of people haven't heard of them. But My Hero Academia has sold more than 25 million books and is hugely popular as a TV series and now the second feature film. In this alternate world, 80% of children are born with quirks, extrasensory powers that make them superheroes. The main character in the series, though, Izuku Deku Midoriya, was born without one, although he was later given one because of his noble spirit. He's untidy, he's fretful, he's insecure, but he is a dedicated superhero in training. He and his classmates at UA High, where they're learning to be superheroes, are helping people on a peaceful island when the villain Nine arrives. He's been stealing quirks from other characters, but using them has so overtaxed his body, he needs a healing quirk possessed by a little boy. Well, while their classmates take out his henchmen, Deku and his friend rival Katsuki tackle the villain. And here the director pulls out all the stops in the battle. There are explosions and lightning and punches and kicks and more explosions and storm clouds and even more explosions. He gives this fight a kind of Kandinsky pastel palette that's very, very striking. And one reason I think this series is so popular is that in a time of blatant self-promotion and naked greed, Deku is a hero who will sacrifice himself to protect the weak, not for glory or for rewards, but because it's the right thing to do. And I think that's a very welcome message.
Charles Solomon reviewing My Hero Academia, Heroes Rising, and the film. New film is in selected theaters. It's rated PG-13, directed by Kenji Nagasaki. The Whistlers is a Romanian crime drama that's written and directed by Corneliu Porumboiu. The film stars Catrinel Marlon and Vlad Ivanov. Tim, what did you think of The Whistlers?
I rather enjoyed it, generally speaking, as I do most of Corneliu's film. Corneliu made Police Adjective.
Mm-hmm.
He made 1208 East of Bucharest. This is the way to contextualize his films in your mind. He makes Coen Brothers films. He's only one guy, but he makes Coen Brothers films. But like old Coen Brothers films, his films have a very blood simple sort of flow to them.
Very distinct.
That kind of thing is what he does. So here we have this cop. He's kind of a crooked cop. This femme fatale, I mean, she has a red dress and everything. I mean, she's just femme fatale stamped right on her forehead there. She comes to him and she says, I want you to do this thing. I'm not going to do it. And he knows they're being watched. And they are. We can see all of the cameras and the perspectives of the people being watched. So she does that whole fake thing where she pretends to kiss him and they're going to be lovers. I'll pretend to be the prostitute. They go into the room. All of this is going on. Cameras all over the room. He keeps telling her, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to do it. The whole time, she's setting him up to do it. What she wants him to do is come to this island in the Canaries, Canary Islands, learn this whistling language, an actual language that these people speak by whistling. By whistling, they can avoid all of the high technology stuff that the police have. The cameras and the microphones.
That's a funny concept.
It's a very funny concept. And what's weird, I'm watching. So, look, they have sex. He's like, okay, whatever you want, I'll do it. Before you know it, he's trying to save her all the way through the movie. She's just an excellent femme fatale. I'm watching this movie, and I'm thinking, she walks up to me and says, hey, Tim, I want you to do something. You know what, sister, whatever you want.
Even learn whistling.
Yeah, whatever you want. You got it. Right now, I'm already out.
That's why you learn the language.
The whistlers. Angie, what'd you think?
I liked it a little bit less than you did. I thought it was fine. It took me a while to get a handle on the tone and what this movie was trying to do. The tone is it's funny, but in a very, very dry way. So
yes.
I think it took me quite a long time to figure out what am I doing here? Where is this going? So I think that may have contributed to it. But I also the characters are kind of flat, I think, by design, but it also made it hard for me to get too invested in them. That said, I mean, the premise of the whistling language is very interesting and unusual. I've never seen that before. And I also thought some of the individual scenes and sequences were really standouts, like the one where the very unfortunate filmmaker comes and interrupts what they're doing. I don't want to say what happens, but yeah.
What'd you think, Claudia, the Whistlers?
I think I liked it even a little bit less than you, so we're going down here.
Yeah.
But there are not enough movies about whistling. I mean, we come on.
Well, there was the old radio series, The Whistler. That was the closest we came.
But I thought it was kind of intermittently clever. But I think the flatness of the characters got to me, too. And I have liked other Romanian movies quite a bit.
Yeah, The Death of Mr. Lazarescu.
Yes.
Oh, what
yes.
a great
And what
film.
Was the 4 months, three
yes.
weeks? Yeah, yeah, that one. And I did like Police Adjective as well. There was kind of a surplus of plot twists and double crosses and... I don't know. It left me a little bit cold. I thought the language was interesting, though.
The Whistlers is the film from writer-director Corneliu Porumboiu. It's unrated. You can see The Whistlers at Lemley's Royal in West Los Angeles. Guns Akimbo, an action comedy, stars Daniel Radcliffe and Samara Weaving. It's written and directed by Jason Lee Howden. Angie, you want to start us on Guns Akimbo?
Sure. So the premise is essentially it's Daniel Radcliffe with guns for hands. So he gets dragged in against his will to this deadly online game. And by guns for hands, I mean these people kidnap him and literally just bolt guns into his hands. He can't get them out of his hands
Edward
ever.
Edward Scissorhands guns.
Mm. Yes, yeah. Basically. So I feel like if you hear that description and you're like, that sounds like a lot of fun, then it might be worth checking out. There's a lot of, kind of silly stuff here. There's some of the best parts are learning how hard it is to go through everyday life when you have guns for hands. You can't do things like open a door or go to the bathroom. That part of it is fun. Some of the action is really fun if you don't mind that super violent video gamey style of action. But I don't know. I think the film falters a bit when it tries to reach for something a little bit deeper or more profound. Like, it wants to be a movie that is about, I don't know, the perils of social media or cyberbullying or how we're all on our phones too much or something like that, but it doesn't really quite have anything that interesting to say about that.
Yeah. So he's this internet tech guy, and what he's doing is he's trolling trolls. Just this game is being played online. Yeah,
right.
It's horrible. It's kind of like what was the one with Arnold Schwarzenegger, Running Man, and people watching online. And we're always cutting to people watching the game online. These sort of ordinary people, and it's run by this evil mastermind. This group called Schism. It's called
Schism
or something like that, right? So Daniel is trolling the trollers, and he says these terrible things. They kidnap him. They do all that to him. The notion is he doesn't want to be violent. He's not a violent guy. And it works for a little while. But it comes to a point of where when he starts being violent is when he starts winning. So I don't get what's going on here. Are we trolling these internet guys or are we not? Are we saying that this is okay or are we not? Because he wins when he does what they do.
Yeah, I think the movie is kind of trying to have it both ways. And to that point, I think we had discussed a little bit before the show, but it's a movie that is kind of sort of about cyberbullying and trolling and whatnot. And the director, Jason Lee Howden, is currently caught up in his own controversy that is essentially boils down to a long series of cycle of people cyberbullying each other and him being one of the people. So it kind of just feels like...
It's the same irony that's in this movie.
Yeah.
Samara Weaving is in this movie, though. Let me shout her out. She's the bomb.
She's good.
Love her. She was in the movie a couple of weeks ago. She's like a young Margot Robbie, only like meaner and crazier.
She was also really great in Ready or Not.
Ready or Not, that's the one. Yeah,
I love seeing her just get bloodied up and go around on a rampage. I also thought Daniel Radcliffe was very, very good. I love that post Harry Potter, he's taken on all these kind of oddball roles and he's having a lot of fun with it. And I think that I think a lot of the credit for what works about this movie can go to him. Like, he does really seem like a guy that you want to watch. He seems like a very ordinary guy. I don't know. I feel like I was rooting for the character more because I thought he brought a lot to it.
Guns Akimbo is the film, the action comedy from writer-director Jason Lee Howden. The film is rated R and it's in selected theaters. Also want to mention that you get a chance now every Saturday, a couple hours after Film Week, to see The Frame Weekend. It's a brand new Best of The Frame that we put on Saturdays at 2 o'clock right here on KPCC. The Frame now on weekends. John Horn will highlight the week's biggest stories in arts and entertainment. It's The Frame Weekend every Saturday at 2 o'clock right after the BBC News Hour here on 89.3 KPCC. We have many more films to talk about. Also, we're going to ask you about your favorite movies with political themes of all time. I have to go way back. Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, that Frank Capra classic with Jimmy Stewart. But you can pick your favorite. That's coming up back in 90 seconds on Film Week. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. Joined this week by critics Angie Hahn of Mashable, Tim Cogshell of CineGods.com, and Claudia Puig, LA Film Critics Association president. Our next film, The Jesus Rolls, is a spinoff of The Big Lebowski. John Turturro directs the film. Angie, what'd you think?
Okay, so this is a spinoff of The Big Lebowski that is also, for some reason, a remake of this 1974 French film, Going Places. It's an odd combination. I'm not really sure why they decided that it needed to be both of those things. It's to the extent that I think this film might actually work better if you are not someone who is hugely invested in The Big Lebowski. I saw it with my husband, who is hugely invested in The Big Lebowski, and he just had like a what the heck kind of look on his face the whole time. It is very odd. It's not very good, but occasionally it ends up being charming in a goofy, almost innocent sort of way. Like, it's a sex farce where basically, so Jesus gets out of jail, he meets up with his best friend Bobby Cannavale, and then they just kind of wander around stealing stuff and having sex, and yeah. That's the whole movie. No one in it ever acts like a real person. The dialogue and the performances are sometimes verge on painful because they're just so stiff and strange. But I can't say I'm mad that I watched it. So I guess that's something.
The Jesus Rolls, starring John Turturro, who directed the film. It's rated R. You can see it at the ArcLight Hollywood and at the Lemley's Monica Film Center and Lemley's Playhouse Pasadena. Burden stars Forrest Whitaker, Usher Raymond, and Garrett Hedlund. Andrew Heckler is the writer-director of Burden. Tim?
This is another one of those Redemption of a Klansman movies.
It's a subgenre.
Set in 1996 in South Carolina. Interesting that it's set in South Carolina, given the political moment that we're in right now. But in 1996, in this small town, loosely based on true events, very, very, very loosely, young man and his Klansmen brethren opened this museum, a KKK museum in this small southern town, mostly
it's
white.
Museum of the Redneck.
Museum of the Redneck, yeah. And KKK with the flag and the whole thing. Some of the items in the museum are actually kind of interesting. In this black community, Forrest Whitaker is this preacher who's gathering the community to push back against this. This is one particular young white man who's at the center of all of this, kind of a son-like figure to the head of this Klan organization. He falls in love with this young woman played by Andrea Riseborough, who is not prejudiced at all. And basically, she tells him, look, if you're going to be with me, you have to reject all of that. It's a difficult situation for him. He was raised by these people. So we find ourselves in one of these stories. Moving, very specific, interesting in certain ways. We hang around with the black folks, Usher and all those folks, and we hang around with these Klans people. But we come to know all of the things that we already know. The Klansmen are terrible people.
What?
What a shock.
Yeah, they're just no good over there. But this movie is working real hard to redeem this one guy. And perhaps he is redeemed. Okay, fine. But I just, we're going to make a whole movie about the redemption of one guy in the Klan. I just don't know. I don't think so. I don't think that's where the effort should go, even if it turns out to be fairly decent filmmaking in and of itself. Garrett Hedlund was also in Mud, by the way, if you recall him. He's very good in that.
I don't even think it was that good of filmmaking. I think it's a great cast, and there were some good performances. But I thought at times the direction wasn't great, and it veered into that white savior territory, and it's sort of like the love of a good white woman. That's all you need to not be racist anymore.
It sounded, though, like the savior was the African-American preacher, though.
Well,
right?
He should have been, yeah. And that's how, you know, some of us would look at it. But they're trying to redeem him so much to the point where literally he's baptized, and you're supposed to be rooting for him. But he's still kind of, even after he renounces the Klan, he's still not a great guy. And he's causing all this havoc to this wonderful preacher's family. And then you have Tom Wilkinson, who's a wonderful actor, as he's like the head Klansman guy. And he's kind of a surrogate father to him. And he's just pure evil Klansman. Yeah. There's no good about him. But he doesn't have a Southern accent. Everybody else in it has a Southern accent.
It's a transplant.
And Brits can usually do good Southern accents. Yeah. So that was a little weird. I don't know. It just, you know, there were some good performances there. I thought Andrea Riseborough, Forest Whitaker was great. But there were a lot of ticks in Garrett Hedlund's performance. And
yes.
Unnecessarily so.
You thought same, Angie?
I feel like his performance was like 70% just him swaying back and forth. I just never found him to be at all convincing. But I also, as you guys have both said, this movie expends a lot of time and energy on the redemption of the soul of just this one KKK guy. And I kind of wish the movie had treated with as much care and sensitivity some of the other characters around him, especially some of the people that he is victimizing throughout the movie. So it just ends up that everyone in this movie is just kind of in service of this guy going from being terrible to being gradually less terrible.
Yeah.
Burden,
maybe okay.
Burden is the film. It's rated R. Forest Whitaker stars Andrew Heckler, the writer-director. It's at the Arclight Hollywood, AMC Century City, and the Landmark West LA. The documentary Scream Queen, My Nightmare on Elm Street, interviews the lead actor, Mark Patton, 30 years after the film's release, Nightmare on Elm Street 2. Roman Kimienti and Tyler Jensen are the directors. Tim?
Nightmare on Elm Street 2, this is a very interesting documentary about this, not particularly successful at the time film, coming on the heels of the very successful Wes Craven film, right? So this film is just about the gayest film ever. And I'm, you know, look, 1984, I'm watching this film, and I thought to myself, this is just about the gayest film ever. And it was, I rather enjoyed it, and I thought it was an interesting notion to twist all of the notions of the Scream Queen and make the Scream Queen a Scream King. His character in this movie is basically playing the female character in any other hack and slash movie you want to see. There's a young woman who's trying to save him in this movie. Freddy Krueger has insinuated himself physically into his body in this movie. When you watch it now, it's all, you know, screaming. And by the way, let me point this out. I didn't know this movie was gay in 1984. My wife pointed out to me that this movie was gay in 1984. She tapped me and she said, you know, this movie's gay, right? I'm like, what? And then suddenly it was like insanely obvious, but it took a moment, right? Way back then, the gay community got it. Mark, Mr. Patton, who was the star of this movie, he was an in-the-closet gay man at that time. This film more or less destroyed his career. And he was a rising star. He had been on Broadway, Jimmy Dean, Back to the 5'9" Jimmy Dean with Cher and everybody. He was a rising young star. And what happened here completely destroyed his career. It was the 80s. Fascinating film. Crosses into the territory that has to do with the rise of the AIDS epidemic and HIV and all of that kind of stuff. Very, very, very interesting stuff. And he ultimately, the writer of the film admits that he very purposely wrote this film as a gay piece of cinema. He denied it for almost 40 years, 35 years he denied it. He admits it in this movie.
Wow. Scream Queen, My Nightmare on Elm Street, a documentary is unrated at Lemley's Glendale Theater. Well, now we're going to take some time to talk on this weekend of the South Carolina primary and Super Tuesday and the California primary just coming up on Tuesday. A chance to talk about the best political films of all time, specifically those that have to do with elections or Congress or the White House. And I'd love to hear from you. If you're listening Friday to our live film week, you can call us at 866-893-KPCC with your favorites. You can also post them on our film week page, either Friday or Saturday at kpecc.org. And let's go back and listen to one of the classics of the genre, and that is Mr. Smith Goes to Washington from 1939, the Frank Capra classic. James Stewart, political novice, appointed to fill a vacant Senate seat, and he goes after the rampant corruption right on the floor of the Senate.
I stand guilty as framed because Section 40 is graft. And I was ready to say so. I was ready to tell you that a certain man in my state, a Mr. James Taylor, wanted to put through this dam for his own profit. A man who controls a political machine and controls everything else worth controlling in my state. Yes, and a man even powerful enough to control congressmen. And I saw three of them in his room the day I went up to see him.
The Senator, yield.
No, sir, I will not yield.
All right, from Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. Once again, if you're listening live Friday, you can call 866-893-KPECC. EDB says two of Ken Loach's, the British filmmaker's movies, Land and Freedom and The Wind That Shakes the Barley. 866-893-KPECC for Friday listeners. Saturday or Friday, you can post on the Film Week page at kpecc.org. We'll continue with our critics and take your input on the best political movies of all time in just 1 minute.